Coming up on today's program.
A lot of those people were moving, too. I mean, they hated to leave their family and friends, but they had to do it to survive, you know, that kind of thing. So we weren't the only family, especially around that time, because a lot of the mines were closing down.
Keeping Appalachian stories alive in Southwest Ohio. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. That story coming up in segment two of today's program. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. Up first in the program today, we've got a new episode of We Outside, which celebrates the joy of getting outdoors and the variety of voices it brings together. Trey Elsie, creator and host, is our guide.
I grew up in inner city Detroit, and after many moves, twists, and turns, I found myself here in inner city Dayton, where I stumbled across a true jewel in the Gem City, the Five Rivers Metro Parks. Knowing that these parks are here for me when I need them feels as comforting as the garden in my childhood backyard, the one my mother filled with tomatoes and care. I wanted to know what these spaces meant to others in my community, so I asked. I talked to two women, making these spaces feel more like home. First up is Sheena Johnson, Community Outreach Specialist at Five Rivers Metro Parks. Her job? Making sure these parks reflect the full diversity of our community and making sure everyone knows there's room for them here.
The primary group that I engage in my role is all the marginalized community. So people of color, we want to get into the LGBTQ+ community, and people with disabilities want to make sure that things are accessible and equitable.
Sheena didn't grow up camping or hiking, but her time with the Metro Parks has changed her relationship to nature.
Now, am I super outdoorsy? No, but working with the parks, I've learned to kayak and learn more about trails. And so it feels good to be outside, and I'm learning more about nature.
What kinds of programs are y'all offering for the communities?
Well, this year, gardening has been a hit. So at Possum Creek, you can like pick your own flowers, pick your own herbs, have a date night out there. The staff there has been doing garden-to-go kits, which is basically seedlings of tomatoes, peppers, and basil, and also get a bag of seeds. We also do seed giveaways in the communities.
And she knows that building trust with communities who haven't always felt welcome takes more than a flyer. It takes showing up and being seen.
I am a big supporter of representation matters. I want you to go to the website, get to know where the parks are located. You know, you're within 5 to 10 minutes of a park, no matter where you live in Montgomery County. And then know that each park has different features, different things that you can try. Just take a walk to de-stress, clear your head, feel the breeze, put your feet in the grass. Like, we have a connection to nature that relaxes us and is good for our mental and physical health.
Every Monday evening at Deeds Point Metro Park, a group of people, mostly from the Black community, gather to walk. They stretch, they breathe. They laugh. At the center of it is Tiffany Brown, a nurse practitioner and a yoga teacher whose journey into healing started with a spiritual awakening.
One morning, I just heard this voice say, "There's room for you." And it was my grandmothers and their mothers talking to me, and I was singing and dancing and laughing and crying, and I got out the shower and looked at myself in the mirror. Didn't see me. I saw like all these women standing behind me. I just got this strong feeling of like yesness.
That moment led Tiffany to become a yoga teacher and to start leading these weekly walks at Deeds Point Park.
Doing community-based yoga in Deeds Point Park was the first place, and so it's accessible, it's beautiful.
I joined them one Monday evening for a brisk walk, and afterwards we circled up under the trees. Before heading home, Tiffany invited us to share something that we were grateful for.
I am here, and one thing I'm grateful for is I am grateful for peace of mind, y'all. I have it, and I am in a good place mentally, which hasn't been the case in these last few years, so I'm thankful for my peace of mind.
These parks hold more than trails and trees. They hold transformation. And if you've never been to one, there's one just 10 minutes from wherever you are in Montgomery County. This is Trey Elsie, and We Outside.
Trey Elzey, a graduate of WISO's Community Voices Training Program, is back next week with a new episode of We Outside. The series is supported by Five Rivers Metro Parks. Cincinnati's Urban Appalachian Community Coalition is turning 50 this year. The group has spent decades supporting folks with Appalachian roots living in Southwest Ohio and helping to keep their stories alive. For WISO's Culture Couch, Myra Morehart talked with historian Nola Hadley Torres about an oral history project she worked on in the 80s and 90s, interviewing Appalachian women who had moved to the city.
I'm interviewing June Tyler,
Faye Massey,
Lorreen Pritchard at her home in Price.
My name is Nola Hadley Torres. I started to do these interviews as part of a history PhD program back in 1988.
Would you say a little bit about your grandparents' background? Would you describe a mealtime at your house?
A mealtime.
Would you just describe the school?
One of the largest in-citizen migrations in the United States were Appalachians migrating to the north after World War II. And Cincinnati had a long sustained record of urban Appalachian activism and organizations. And a lot of research had already been done. I was interested in finding out, how does urbanization affect Appalachian migrants, particularly women?
I just turned 13. I remember my first look of Cincinnati coming off that ramp, you know, into Lower Price Hill. It was in January. Now it was garbage day. Okay. So you can imagine how absolutely nasty it was. Well, it was almost like I was hyperventilating, you know, because things were just so closed in and everything. I sure never appreciated hazard like I did after we moved up here. We had no choice because of work. A lot of those people were moving, too. I mean, they hated to leave their family and friends, but they had to do it to survive, you know, that kind of thing. So we weren't the only family, especially around that time, because a lot of the mines were closing down.
You know, as a historian, we're very discouraged against oral histories. Oral histories are hard to validate. Did this really happen? What's the evidence? But there's a whole lot of the population that you cannot find a paper trail for. The other advantage of doing oral histories is you can get to what events meant to people.
When I came here, I didn't know that I was so different. I didn't know that I talked funny. I didn't know that people thought I was ignorant because I was from the mountains.
I felt like a real oddball, and my clothes didn't fit in with everybody else's. I mean, you know, my old homemade clothes and hand-me-downs.
I forget how many interviews I did in whole. 28? Yeah, I think that's right. Most of the time, people were very welcoming, and, you know, it was kind of more like you're sitting with your buddy. I don't know how to explain it.
I can remember being about 3 or 4 years old, maybe 5. I'd wake up on a warm summer morning and I'd go into the kitchen and Granny would be out in the garden hoeing, and she'd have this old wood stove, and she'd have on the back of it, on back there staying warm, a big bowl of gravy and potatoes and biscuits. And I'd get me a biscuit and I'd go out in the garden and I'd pluck me a ripe tomato off the vine, and I'd sit down there in the garden without washing the tomato, eat the tomato and the biscuit. And Granny used to think I was weird because I loved her biscuits with onions and tomatoes for breakfast.
I just wanted to get a picture of family life, and it was so different between narrators who lived in really close proximity to one another. Because people have stereotypes of all of Appalachia as being extremely poor, I just wanted to get a better picture of that.
And so we had this big old square house. It had 4 rooms.
I'd carry water. I'd work outside.
Do all the hard work, like chopping, kindling, and digging coal, and those kinds of things.
And then we raised enough vegetables to do us year-round.
I think over the course of the interviews, as I found out more and more about each of the women, I just felt so much respect for them. Almost all of them gave me information about being extremely motivated to support their families and their community.
Now, I don't know if it's because I'm an Appalachian, but I've got something inside me that is just keeps me going, because I have been through a lot, and I got a real sense of pride for where I'm from, who I am. You know, was ever going to make me ashamed of where I'm from. I'm proud, boy. I'm proud to be an Appalachian. If you call me a hillbilly, doesn't bother me. I'm proud of it, you know?
If you want to hear the full interviews from this story, you can check them out at KentuckyOralHistory.org. We Outside and Culture Couch is produced at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO. Culture Couch is made possible with support from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to Why So Weekend. Thanks so much for tuning in. Up next, it's WYSO Youth Radio. In 2014, WYSO launched Youth Radio to give high school students the opportunity to speak for themselves. WYSO intern Lee Wade is our host for this series.
Hey there. You just tuned into WYSO Youth Radio. We're working with high schoolers across the area to share their stories through sound. This next generation turned all the way up. We're heading back to Ponet's Career Technology Center and meeting Demaya Woodall. She has aphantasia, which means she can't visualize images in her mind's eye.
How would you feel if you couldn't visualize or imagine things?
I would kind of feel hopeless.
It would make me feel something was wrong with me.
I'd constantly be on my phone or computer and print out things so I could refer to them.
I feel like I'd be dumb. I just feel like it would really squash my creativity.
I'd probably be a lot more productive.
I think I'd be pretty scared. If I couldn't see it anymore, it'd just be like, oh my gosh, what happened? What's going on?
Aphantasia, the inability to visualize. I never knew there was a name for it until the conversation with my friend Haley Chavez.
I was just talking about this guy. I feel like I always create such a image of him in my head. I just am very delusional and I daydream about us together. And you just basically told me that you couldn't picture these scenarios that I was picturing with the person I like.
Throughout my daily life dealing with aphantasia, it affects me during conversational storytelling or educational instances. When it comes to storytelling, that's where having aphantasia is most annoying. When telling a story, some people love to go into grave detail. They always start with something like this. I was standing in the corner next to the blue sofa with the crazy colored pillows, and outside it was starting to get dark. And then I'm just there like, can we just get to the point? But I, someone who loves writing many different things, understands that's a big part of storytelling, so I don't blame anyone for doing it. It's just details like that ultimately don't help me understand the story more. Now when it comes to school, I found myself needing written or printed explanations of things so I can actually get the idea of how to do something. Along with that, when starting projects or writing assignments, I like to have examples of how I can start creating my own things. As far as when I was a kid, I would always try to play imagination with other kids, but I could never see the world how they saw it. No dragons, princesses, far-off majestic lands, none of it. Every time I played, I got tired of it fast and went back to what I know best, which is words. Which is why I feel aphantasia was a part of the reason I fell in love with words. Words for me are how I think. I guess you could even say how I view the world. Now that I know I'm not alone in how I view the world, I can now recognize everyone views it differently. I'm not weird for something I can't control. There isn't a correct or normal way to visualize things. One thing I can say is don't let something as small as having aphantasia affect how you live. As I mentioned earlier, I'm interested in writing stories, and I'm following that dream by studying cinema and media studies in college. I didn't let my lack of visualization stop me from letting people get the chance to see my words come to life. One more thing I want to say is to look for the name of something you think makes you different. You might find why some of your experiences seem unique. When you find that thing, look at it as a gift, not a burden. Aphantasia is my gift, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
Thank you, Demaya Woodall, for sharing your experience with aphantasia. And a big shout out to Joanne Cassell for making it happen. WYSO Youth Radio is made possible with the support from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. And it's produced right here at WYSO in the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices.
We've got new episodes of WYSO Youth Radio out on Thursdays every week. It's the series where students from our community share their voices and stories. And if you missed an episode, you can catch up anytime and listen to past seasons at WYSO.org. Up next, well, this week for WYSO City Mayor Series, I paid a visit to the city of Huber Heights, which has experienced tremendous growth in the last few years. And while Mayor Jeff Gore says there is a limit to that growth, he says they're still working to bring more businesses to the city that he says has everything.
I don't say this lightheartedly. I mean, I could not be happier and more pleased with where we are. We are finally kind of in a place where we have our senior administrative staff kind of understands the vision, but what's really great is their vision is kind of council's vision. So that's kind of gelling now. Everyone on council, although everybody has some different opinions on how we get there, everybody still wants to get there. So my line might be from A to B, their line might have A to A point A, A point B, A point C before they finally get to B, right? But I have confidence that we're going to get to B. And I think that is a level of confidence that I haven't had over the last, you know, well, from 2018 through probably 2023, because as much as I appreciated some of the different direction that some other council people wanted to go, it wasn't where I wanted to go. And not that my opinion is the end-all, be-all, but it was the majority opinion of council. And really all that matters is we're doing the right things for the taxpayers, we're getting a return on their investment, and attracting the businesses and the growth that so many people in this community have said they've wanted over the years.
You mentioned consensus on the vision for Huber Heights. Let's talk about what that vision is. I've heard it said that Huber Heights won't stop until they're the biggest city in the state. What do you think of that commentary, and what is the vision actually?
I've seen a lot of people talk about this reaching 50,000 in population. So there, if that happens, great, but that's not the driving force. I've read people think there's all this government funding that will come from the state if you have 50,000 people, and that isn't necessarily the case. It's helpful. But if you have 50,000 people, the state classifies you as what's called an entitlement city. And there is extra available funds from the state. I don't know that it's actually extra funds, or it kind of cuts out the middleman in how that money transfers from the state to the city. You know, we're probably still 6,000 to 7,000 people away from that. I don't know that there's that much more room to grow here. I mean, you know, we do have boundaries. The annexation that just happened into Bethel Township certainly isn't. I mean, that's going to be maybe another 2,500 people, but that's not going to put us to 50,000. So people who are against the growth, who just think I'm on this mission to become a city of 50,000 people, they just couldn't be further from the truth. If that happens, that happens. The ultimate goal for me has always been to attract more business, because the more businesses you have paying business tax and things like that to the city, that increases that tax base. The goal is always being able to try to reduce the tax burden on the people, right? So that's kind of the ultimate goal. But what we do know is that businesses follow rooftops. It isn't the other way around. And I can't yell this from the rooftops enough, right? You don't just build a business out in the middle of a field and expect that people are going to come. It's not like Field of Dreams. It isn't a build it and they will come scenario. Economics doesn't work that way. Businesses have to have the confidence that there's enough people that will frequent their business for them to be successful, so they'll make that investment into the community.
You mentioned the rooftops and the people living under them. What else do Huber Heights citizens want that they maybe don't have yet, or what do they like about living here?
Sure. Well, so I think people are always much happier if they love the space they're in, right? So that's kind of the thing. So that's why we're focused so much on trying to build experiences around Huber Heights, because we also know that's what attracts younger families, right? It's about the experience, how you feel in the place that you occupy. So that's why we're trying to create an entertainment district, a place that is people can come and enjoy and experience that space and then want to come back. We've got 15 parks here that occupy over, you know, well over 200 acres. And So people talk about park space. We don't have enough green space. We're overbuilding. But there's 200 acres of park space here as well that people can enjoy. I think the one area that people have talked about for so long is, well, we have too many quick serve restaurants. We don't have enough full dining restaurant experiences here. But those are coming, because those same restaurants who, as I talked about before, they have to know they're going to have a strong customer base to support those businesses. Otherwise, why is it worth the risk of their investment to do that? So we've focused a lot on that. And as we announced at the State of the City address, we will have two new full-service restaurants coming to the entertainment district there on Executive Boulevard. And I think as other businesses start to see the success of that, I think only more will decide, hey, you know what, that's a place that we want to be. That's a place that can help our business. So that's really kind of been a thing. And then we really are focusing on beautifying the rest of the city. We've done some things to the north side, and we certainly have plans to continue that along the southern side of the city. You know, we caught some grief for some people for buying the shopping center at Brant Pike and Fishburg. But we did that. A lot of people think that the city doesn't belong in the real estate business or being in the rental business. But, you know, what we were able to do is turn that shopping center around, and the space is about to be full, and we've increased the actual rent space in those buildings that is on the southern side of town that's been kind of an eyesore for a long time. And we hope that we're showing the citizens that, you know what, we actually do know what we're doing here. And we can continue creating a better space, a better experience for the residents that live on the southern side of town, south of Fishburg, and which is the older section of the city. It's all Ward 5, all the way down to Claude Park. So it's a long-term vision. It's a long-term process. These things don't happen overnight. And I understand that people don't always understand and see kind of what the big picture, because it does take a long time to make some of those things happen. But we are definitely about beautifying the city, making people feel better and happy in the space that they're in, the space they occupy, giving people more variety in where they go, where they dine, how they spend their money, how they entertain themselves. And I think right now, when you talk to a lot of people in the city, short of some other type of dining experience, everything that someone needs is right here. They don't have to go very far to get everything that they need. It's all available right here in Huber.
Huber Heights Mayor Jeff Gore, thanks so much for the conversation.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Up next on Why So Weekend, we've got a new episode of Translucent, a series by Antioch College student WYSO intern Lee Wade, and he's back to explore the issues shaping trans lives.
Hi, I'm Lee Wade, and you're listening to Translucent, a series that amplifies trans voices, humanizes our community, and creates space for the real everyday conversations that don't make headlines. In November 2024, Ohio Senate Bill 104 sat on Governor Mike DeWine's desk, awaiting his signature to become law. The bill would require individuals in schools and colleges to use restrooms and other facilities that align with their sex assigned at birth. Kathy Bowers, an instructor at Sinclair Community College, a Republican and a trans woman, wrote a letter in response. Here she reads excerpts from that letter.
The Honorable Mike DeWine, Governor of the State of Ohio. As some background, I'm a 63-year-old transgender woman that has lived my life as Kathy since March of 2020. My name has been legally changed, my driver's license has been changed, including my gender marker. I've had gender-affirming surgery, and I've worked as an instructor at Sinclair Community College since the fall of 2021 after almost a 40-year career in manufacturing. If this bill becomes law, I will be forced to use a man's restroom while employed. My first reaction to this bill was anger. This would be extremely awkward and embarrassing for me. Imagine I'm in the middle of a class I teach and we go on break. I will then, as a female in all aspects at this point in my life, have to follow my students into the men's restroom. I teach industry-related classes, so most of my students are male. This law will basically have the effect of tattooing a red T on my forehead. Once I got over my initial anger, my emotions changed to fear. There are plenty of people out there that want to instill violence upon transgender females. This bill now increases the opportunity for those people by increasing the chances of the two parties interacting with each other. Governor DeWine, generationally, we are not that far apart. Think back to when you were in school. How were gay children treated at that time? Not well, right? How do you think a transgender girl is going to be treated by cisgender boys in today's culture when she is forced to use the boys' restroom? It generally hurts to know that a party for which I used to be proud to be a member wants to perpetuate a fearful environment on a small portion of the population. I appreciate the time you've taken to read this letter, assuming he read it.
What encouraged you to write the letter to Governor Mike DeWine?
You know, it's basically been probably 3 or 3.5 years since I've went into a men's restroom. And it's just, I mean, how embarrassing is that going to be? And then the complication is if I decide I'm going to ignore this and go in and use the women's restroom, then I'm violating the law. And I like to think I'm a law-abiding citizen.
How do you think this will affect transgender people?
You see the studies where the increased thoughts of having suicide. I've never had those thoughts, but as this starting to pressure's coming on, I can understand a young child getting pushed over the edge. I think because I'm so old, it's like, what have I got to lose? I mean, it's like not as much bothers me at my age in that regard, you know. But when I sit there and see the ramifications behind other people, it's just their lives are just starting or haven't even started. I just can't imagine why you would do that to a young person.
What message do you have for politicians who are making these anti-trans bills?
My hunch would be there's more politicians back in the day would stand up against this. But now everybody's afraid. They just follow the leader. So my thing to kind of summarize would be for the politicians to try to understand transgender people. Meet some, talk to them. Get a feel for it. Not just listen to some headlines or your whoever sponsors this bill, listen to their rhetoric.
On November the 27th, 2024, Senate Bill 104 was signed into law and took effect on February the 25th, 2025. For many trans and non-binary people in Ohio, it marked as a setback, but it also sparked a powerful movement for change. I'm Lee Wade, and thank you for listening to Translucent.
Translucent is made possible by support from the Ruby Girls Foundation and is produced at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WYSO.
This is Bird Note. A bird's bill is perhaps one of nature's most incredible multi-tools. Good for preening feathers, self-defense, scratching, displaying, building a nest, and turning eggs. The bill of each bird species is perfectly adapted to meet the needs of that species, whether it's probing for worms, cracking open seeds, or tearing into fresh meat. And a bird's bill must do things that other animals accomplish with paws or other appendages. In a marsh or wet meadow, you might see a great blue heron impale a fish with its massive spearhead of a bill. Or perhaps you'll spot a mallard using its spatula-like bill to sift tiny animals and plants out of the water. The Wilson snipe uses its long, slender bill to probe the dirt for earthworms, while a peregrine falcon uses its sharp-hooked beak to tear apart its prey. Call it a beak or call it a bill. For each and every bird, it tells a story. Next time you go birding, see what a bird's beak can tell you. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know Bird Note delivers the wonder and joy of birds directly to your inbox? Sign up for our newsletter at birdnote.org to get a weekly preview of our shows, stories, photos, and more.
Alas, that's a wrap for this edition of WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for sharing your weekend with WYSO. We've got more stories for you coming next week. Please tune in then.